The events of 2020 have been challenging for journalists to cover. The stories that have dominated the news cycle, from the election to wildfires, and of course the pandemic, are all being interpreted by audiences through increasingly divided lenses. To help us think through what this moment has to say about who we are and where we're headed, I spoke with journalist and author Farai Chidea. You may know her from her work with NPR, as an ABC News analyst, a contributor to 538, or from her latest project, the podcast Our Body Politic, which explores how women of color experience and shape politics. Chidea began by sharing her thoughts on objectivity in journalism.
I was never the biggest fan of it. What I'm a fan of, and I've written about this, is fairness. So when I go and interview someone who's an active white supremacist, as I have face-to-face more than once, and many other times, you know, through the phone or running conversations and DMs on Twitter, I am not objective about their ideology. Their ideology has been used to kill people throughout many centuries of history up to the present day. So what am I going to be objective about? Objectively, they support an ideology that kills Black and Brown people, but I have all sorts of feelings about that. However, those feelings do not put me in a position as a reporter where I seek to demonize them or to portray them in ways that are inaccurate. I have been able to have very deep conversations with white supremacists and nationalists for this reason, because I'm just like, yeah, I don't agree with you, but, you know, like, let's chop it up. Tell me why you believe what you believe. And tell me also, like, tell me about your feelings. Like, I find my most recent conversations have focused a lot on things like the anxiety and depression that many white young men who join white nationalist movements feel. That does not excuse them turning to this ideology as a way to make themselves feel powerful, but it helps me understand it. It helps people who I write for or broadcast for understand. So I think it's quite possible to not be objective in the sense of floating on a godlike cloud where you have no feelings, no history, no color, because the only people who've been allowed to float on that cloud are essentially white men. No one assumes that reporters of color are objective. And even if objectivity were the goal, the bias around who is considered objective is a huge problem. For me, I would much rather stand on the plank of fairness. I am fair to people I interview. I do not demonize them. I do not take their words out of context. I spend as much time as I possibly can with them under the circumstances to really get a 360 view of who they are in the context, preferably before COVID, in a physical context, so that I could see them around their friends and their neighbors and at their church, et cetera. So I think that essentially objectivity has long been a construct that said that if you are like the people who are publishing you or putting you on air and various attributes around race, class, gender, et cetera, match up, then you're objective. And if those attributes don't match up, then you have an opinion. And really, so much of journalism has been defined by that, where people who are, you know, air quote, objective journalists were the ones who did horrible coverage about the Central Park Five. People who were, quote, objective journalists were the ones who termed the children born to women using crack, crack babies, when actually scientifically we know now there were not the deleterious effects. There were kids whose parents used crack who turned out just fine. And the ones who didn't, it was because of parental neglect or other reasons. It's not like you're saying, well, there's nothing bad about using crack while you're having a pregnancy. But what you need to do is match up the stories from the crack era and the stories about white women from the opioids era. Both people are using drugs. Some are demonized, some are not. That's what objective journalism has done. And so I stand on the plank of fairness. And I think that lived experience, my lived experience of growing up, not by any means poor, but with a certain degree of financial insecurity, has made me a better reporter, because I try to understand class and income. And I don't make assumptions that everyone is middle class, or that the American middle class spans everyone from people who make $45,000 a year to $500,000 a year.
Right, right.
you know?
Right. Well, let's dive into some of the conversations and some of the reporting that you've done. And I specifically want to talk about politics. You're someone who has covered every election since 1996. Mm-hmm. This is a rather vague question, purposely so. But as you reflect back on this election, what do you think will be some of the key lessons learned?
Oh boy. Well, I think one of the key lessons I've learned is that it's really hard for the media to learn lessons. It's like, oh, in 2016, we over-relied on polls. We're not going to do that again.
We did it again.
Yep, did it again. It's like, wow, in 2016, we really underestimated the impact of racial resentment on the election. We won't do that again. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah.
So I think that one of my lessons learned is that lessons are hard to learn for the journalism industry. But in terms of the broader question of the American public, I think that a lesson that we are still learning, that I hope we learn, is that culture war rules are different from typical rules. Meaning, in a culture war era, which we're in, many people will believe whatever people who espouse their ideology tell them to believe. And I deliberately am not putting this on one political party, although disinformation is not evenly parceled out across the ideological spectrum. It is weighted to the right. And I will say that unapologetically, backed up by tons of research. But there's something called confirmation bias, which is that just kind of naturally human beings seek out information that reassures us about what we already believe. And I deal with that. I have been someone who's had to check my own confirmation bias. And I read pretty expansively, including white supremacist websites and far right wing media and, you know, democratic socialist media, and occasionally even, you know, like the English versions of the state papers of Russia and China or whatever. Like, I want to know what people are saying. I don't have to believe all of it. And it's a good reality check for me to really see the wide ranging types of information out there. But I think what we have to learn is that human beings in a polarized time like this pretty much have pack logic. It's like, I'm going to run with my pack, and whatever people say in my pack, I'm going to run with. So wearing masks doesn't matter. Okay, if your pack is running with that. Now we're seeing this massive COVID spike that was completely predictable. And we're seeing governors of states that refuse to espouse wearing masks for political reasons have to backtrack belatedly to science. But the reason that they didn't espouse it was not really about anything empirical, even about the fear of job loss. It was running with the pack. And so I think that what we need to learn from this is that, you know, something I've been saying a lot recently is you can't fact check a culture war. I mean, you can, but it's just not that useful. It's not going to change minds. It's not going to persuade people. What does help is doing journalism about why people espouse their beliefs and getting down to really a deeper level of human understanding, without which we are going to be in for a rough several years. And we just might be, because I'm not sure that we are learning that lesson.
I spend a lot of time thinking about media literacy. I spend a lot of time thinking about the demands that the internet has put on consumers of information to be mindful of its credibility. And it just seems to me that there isn't much desire amongst the public to put in that hard work to do what you do, to expand the basis of where you're getting your information from. Do you see where will we hit a tipping point at which point this actually becomes important to the American public?
So I think that the tipping point comes really through one of two things. One is transformational leadership, which does not mean top-down leadership. It could mean a widely dispersed group of community leaders basically say, we've got to stop this before we all die. And that could happen in places all over the country. Or we do die, and I don't just mean from COVID, I mean from racial violence, et cetera, and then we say, let's stop this. Unfortunately, history shows that we often take path number two. And Omar Wasso, who's a professor of political science at Princeton, does amazing research on how essentially during the civil rights era, when white Americans saw Black people being brutalized and chewed up by dogs and sprayed with water cannons and not resisting, white Americans in the regions where that was happening and nationally began to embrace the cause of civil rights. But if Black people resisted in any way, they rejected the cause of civil rights. So essentially, the way that Wasso frames it is that seeing people suffer and die without any kind of active resistance is what changes minds. That's a pretty awful lesson to learn from history. And I also don't think it will happen again. I don't think one of the things we talked about on Our Body Politic is Black Americans have been buying guns at a much higher clip than previously for self-protection. Previously, the idea of buying guns for self-protection in the home was kind of a mainly white, mainly right, meaning politically right, NRA type endeavor. There's been a high increase in people who consider themselves politically progressive buying guns and people who are non-white buying guns. I think people are essentially preparing for a civil war. I hope it doesn't happen, but I'm not going to ignore evidence like that. I mean, someone I know who's an extremely wealthy investor who's been tracking this as, you know, work to try to de-escalate says that ammunition sales are up 3 times over where they were last year. And so I am hoping that we pull ourselves back from the brink through essentially internal community-based diplomacy, but I'm also not banking on that happening.
What you just said made me think about the connection between economic instability and some of the divisiveness that we're experiencing in America right now. So before we wrap up, I would like to talk a little bit about economics. You wrote a book a few years back called The Episodic Career, about how to navigate this rapidly evolving workplace and economy. And given the moment that we find ourselves in now as a result of the pandemic and the recession, what are your thoughts about the future of the workplace?
Well, I do think that we are likely to be in a K-shaped recovery from the COVID economic declines, meaning the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. So we're already seeing that the market has yielded some very handsome returns for investors. Bitcoin is up, et cetera. And by and large, wealthy white collar workers have done just fine. People who work in the service industry and many other people who aren't making a lot of money have been devastated. Of all of the race and gender groups, the group that has taken the hardest hit appears to be Latinas. And, you know, when you look at the September unemployment numbers, there was like 3/4 of the unemployment was women. And of them, Latinas were not only the largest group proportionally, but the largest group of women. And so I was talking to a white male, upper middle class friend of mine the other day, and he was like, yeah, I was talking to this friend, and he was like, yeah, everything's fine with the economy. And I said, I don't think so. And I was like, yeah, I bet your friend, similarly to you, is a well-off white man. And he was like, oh yeah, he's rich. And I was like, well, here's some stats, you know? And so I don't know exactly what's going to come of the long run, but I think that, you know, right now, all of the stimulus that could be provided by the government is due to run out. There's a lot of log jams on Capitol Hill. I do suspect that we'll see a lot of desperation that will intensify if we don't act. You know, people who are economically desperate, some of them are psychologically able to be just fine in the sense that they are so deeply resilient that they can weather it. And some people lash out in anger at others, and some people self-destruct. So we've seen, even as people have less money, massive spikes in purchases of opioids because people are depressed. And so if you are already struggling economically and then in that pick up an opioid habit, that's a recipe for complete financial disaster as well as possibly death. And so I know that I'm sounding like a complete Debbie Downer here. So what I would say the upside is that I've also seen people finding new ways to reach that level of resiliency and to prioritize self-care and family. And the pandemic has been a sorting hat. And some of us are doubling down on love and self-care and self-preservation, and others are self-destructing. And that's not even a moral judgment, it's just a fact. And so part of the issue is, what are the external circumstances that we can control collectively through government, through community, that give people the best chance to live the best life? I think that's really the struggle that we face as a society. Like, I give to mutual aid societies. I've made as many financial contributions earlier this year as I could, and I'm gonna take a look at my budget and see what else I can do. But, you know, like, my little oar isn't gonna get the boat to shore, but I can do what I can. And feeling a sense of engagement rather than defeat is really important. So whatever people can do to center themselves, it should not be up to you just having a good attitude to get through this, but it certainly can't hurt to center yourself in some kind of practice of self-compassion, joy, spirituality, if that's your thing, meditation, if that's your thing, exercise, if that's your thing. We're all going to have to dig deep to be the best self we can be under these circumstances.
Well, Farai Chidea, host and creator of the podcast, Our Body Politic, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Kathleen. Really appreciate it.